Welcome back, everyone. It's great to have you with us for another deep dive. Last time, we were looking at, another fascinating chapter in the Handbook of Personal Development. And today, we're going to shift gears a bit and delve into chapter three,
Yes, chapter three.
all about legal frameworks, which, might sound a bit dry at first glance,
That sounded a bit dry.
but trust me, folks, this stuff is crucial. It's like the foundation upon which all those amazing personnel development initiatives are built. We're going to break down this chapter and give you the lowdown on the key regulations and what they really mean for, for anyone involved in developing people and organizations. So buckle up because we're about to navigate the legal landscape that shapes how employee development happens inside organizations, ensuring you gain clarity on this often overlooked but crucial aspect.
Yes, I think a lot of people, they get so excited about the latest training methods or, all the exciting stuff about employee development, but they forget about the legal side of things, which can really trip you up if you're not careful. This chapter kind of serves as a reminder, a reminder that we need to operate within the boundaries set by the law.
Absolutely. And it's not just about avoiding trouble. It's also about understanding how the law can actually be a force for good, in a way, pushing organizations to be more proactive and responsible in how they approach employee development.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
So to kick things off, let's jump into, I think, one of the most significant areas for employee development, and that's the whole realm of collective bargaining and those, what are they called? Co-determination rights?
Yes, co-determination.
Right. And the book dives deep into something called the Works Constitution Act. I mean, it might sound, I don't know, a bit technical or something.
It can be a bit daunting.
But its impact on, how training happens, how employees move forward in their careers, that's huge.
It really is. And that's because the Works Constitution Act, you often see it abbreviated as BETVG, it gives substantial rights to the employee council, especially when it comes to, things like vocational training.
Right, so we're talking about what, like apprenticeships, professional development programs, stuff like that.
Exactly. And one of the key sections here is Section 96.
96, okay.
This section establishes the employee council's right to, to basically be involved in vocational training measures of all kinds. We're not talking about just being informed. We're talking about real participation in decision making.
So it's not just a, hey, we're doing this training FYI kind of situation.
Nope, not at all. The employee council gets to weigh in on some pretty fundamental things. And this includes situations where the employer is footing the bill for the training, whether it's covering the entire cost or just part of it.
Makes sense. And I guess it also covers those times when an employee needs to take time off from their regular duties to participate in these programs, right?
Precisely. Section 96 also covers situations where employees are released from their normal work to attend training. And that's a big deal because it shows that the law recognizes the importance of giving employees the time and space they need to develop their skills.
So it's not just about whether training happens, it's also about the specifics of how it happens.
Exactly.
And the employee council gets a say in those details. Like, for example, if management decides they want to go with, I don't know, a short online training on something, but the employee council thinks a more, in-depth, hands-on approach would be better, who wins that argument?
Well, that's where the whole co-determination thing comes in. The employee council's rights actually extend to quite a few key areas. They have a say in what knowledge will be taught, the actual content of the training, where it's held, how long it lasts, even when it's scheduled. It's quite comprehensive.
Wow, so they really have a lot of influence on how these programs are designed and delivered.
They do. And this can actually be a good thing for everyone involved. Because when employers know they have to get the employee council on board, they're often more inclined to, to really think through the best way to develop their workforce.
Yeah, I can see that. It sort of forces them to be more proactive and consider the needs of the employees from the outset.
Exactly. It's less about just ticking a box and more about genuine collaboration.
And it doesn't stop there, does it? The book also mentions that the employee council has a say in, in who actually gets to be a trainer and even who gets to participate in these training programs.
Oh, absolutely. Their influence extends to the appointment and dismissal of trainers, whether they are internal employees who happen to be experts in something or external trainers brought in specifically for a program.
Okay, so they have a voice in who's leading the training. That makes sense. But how does it work with choosing who gets to participate? I mean, are there ever situations where, I don't know, maybe there are more people interested in a program than there are spots available?
Oh, definitely. And in those cases, the employee council has co-determination rights in the selection of participants. They work with management to ensure that the process is fair and transparent, and that the employees chosen for the training are the ones who will benefit most from it.
And the book actually goes into some detail about how this right to co-determination in vocational training is particularly strong, citing the work of Bosch and others from back in 1995. They pointed out that Section 98, Paragraph 2 of the Works Constitution Act, it gives more specific rights in this area compared to Section 99, which deals with, you know, having a say in more general personnel actions.
Yeah, that's a good point to highlight. What that essentially means is that when it comes to vocational training, the employee council has a stronger position compared to other areas where they have a right to co-determination.
Yeah.
It really emphasizes how important this whole area is considered to be.
So it's not just a general right to be involved. It's a very specific and powerful right when it comes to training and development.
Exactly. The law recognizes that vocational training is crucial for the future of both the employees and the organization.
Now, let's say the employer and the employee council, you know, they hit a snag. They just can't agree on some aspect of these training matters. What happens then? It can't just, like, end in a stalemate, can it?
Well, no. Thankfully, there's a process in place for resolving these kinds of disagreements. If an agreement can't be reached, the employee council has the right to turn to the labor court.
The labor court, okay.
Yes. The labor court can help find a resolution or make a decision that both sides have to abide by. It's a way to ensure that these co-determination rights aren't just theoretical, they have real teeth.
So it's like a safety valve in a way to make sure things keep moving forward, even if there's a disagreement.
Exactly. It prevents things from getting bogged down in endless debates.
And these rights, they even extend to how employees are evaluated to see if they're right for certain training, right? The book mentions things like assessment centers and other testing methods.
That's correct. When employers use selection methods like assessment centers or various types of tests to determine who will participate in training programs, the employee council has a co-determination right in that process as well.
So they can make sure that these selection methods are, you know, fair and transparent.
Precisely. It helps ensure that everyone has an equal chance and that the selection is based on objective criteria, not just someone's gut feeling.
There's also this interesting detail about how participant groups are formed, especially when a training program is open to people from outside the company.
Ah, yes. In those cases, the employee council can participate in decisions about the composition of the participant group, even though it's not just for current employees, but also includes external participants.
So they can still advocate for the development of their own workforce, even in those broader training initiatives.
Precisely. They want to make sure that their own employees are getting a fair shot at those development opportunities, even when external candidates are in the mix.
Okay, so we've talked a lot about the employee council being involved in planning training and, you know, who gets to participate and all that. But the book takes it a step further and says there's actually a possibility of a mandatory requirement for employers to introduce training measures under Sections 90 and 91 of the Works Constitution Act.
Right. So while we've been talking about the employee council's involvement in planned training, Sections 90 and 91 bring in the possibility of the employer actually being required to put training measures in place under certain circumstances.
So it's not just about having a say, it's about a potential obligation to act.
Exactly.
So when would this mandatory requirement kick in? What are the triggers? Let's say, for instance, a company introduces a whole new production line and it requires a very different set of skills from their employees. Would that be something that triggers this mandatory training requirement?
Well, Section 91 of the Works Constitution Act is particularly relevant here. It gives the employee council an absolute right to co-determine when changes to workplaces, work processes, and workflows, as described in Section 90, number 3, result in changes to employee requirements. Essentially, if the way work is done changes in a way that requires employees to have different skills, the employee council can demand that the employer takes action to compensate for these changes.
And that includes providing the necessary training or upskilling, right?
Exactly. This is a powerful tool for the employee council, because it means they can ensure that employees are equipped to handle the changes the company is making.
It's not just about saying no to changes. It's about making sure the employees have the support they need to adapt and stay relevant.
Absolutely.
And, you know, this can be a good thing for employers, too, because if they know they might be required to provide training when they make changes, they're more likely to think about the skills implications of those changes right from the start.
Right. It encourages them to be proactive and plan for the training needs that might arise.
The book then makes a distinction between these collective rights, the ones we've been discussing, and certain individual rights and responsibilities, like discussing job changes with employees under Section 81, Paragraph 3, and the requirement for regular safety training under Section 12 of the Occupational Safety and Health Act. Why is it important to understand the difference between these?
That's a great question. The distinction is important because it clarifies the scope of these different rights. Educational measures aimed at broader skill development, which fall under the co-determination rights of the Works Constitution Act, are not considered mere instructions or information about specific job changes or safety rules, which are covered under individual rights.
So it's about the purpose and scope of the training.
Exactly. Safety training is about ensuring everyone knows the basic rules to prevent accidents, while broader training is about developing new skills and opening up new possibilities for employees.
The book actually gives this specific example of introducing and designing group work. And it says that this can trigger a whole bunch of participation rights under the Works Constitution Act, not just the ones we've already talked about.
Yes, it's a great example of how one change can have a ripple effect. Introducing group work, which changes how employees collaborate and the skills they need, can trigger co-determination rights, not just under sections 90 and 91, which we discussed earlier, but also under other sections related to the organization of work, personnel planning, training, individual personnel decisions, and even larger organizational changes.
Wow. So one change can really set off a chain reaction.
It can. And that's why it's so important for employers to understand these rights and to involve the employee council from the beginning when they're considering making changes.
Now, with all these potential areas for disagreement, things can get pretty complicated. The book mentions that disputes in these areas can be resolved by something called a conciliation board.
Right. If the employer and the employee council can't reach an agreement on matters where the employee council has co-determination rights, they can call upon a conciliation board.
Okay, and what exactly is a conciliation board?
Think of it as a neutral third party made up of representatives from both the employer and the employee council, plus an impartial chairperson.
So they're like mediators.
Exactly. They try to help both sides reach a mutually acceptable solution. And in some cases, they can even make a binding decision to resolve the dispute.
It's like having a referee to make sure the process is fair and that everyone gets a chance to be heard.
That's a good way to put it.
One last thing on this whole collective bargaining front. The book briefly mentions that similar rules exist in, individual state laws about employee representation and in other laws about employee representation in general.
That's right. It's important to remember that the Works Constitution Act, while comprehensive, isn't the only law that gives employees a voice in their own development. There might be other legal frameworks in play, depending on the specific context.
So it's kind of like a web of protections and rights that can vary depending on the industry, the location, and a bunch of other factors.
Precisely. It's always a good idea to consult with legal experts to make sure you're aware of all the applicable regulations.
Okay, let's switch gears a bit and talk about some specifics for the public sector. The book touches on a section of the Federal Personnel Representation Act, specifically Section 78, Paragraph 3, Sentences 1 and 2, which deals with the staff council being consulted on personnel needs when the budget is being planned.
Right, that's an important point. The staff council, which is the equivalent of the employee council in the public sector, has the right to be consulted on personnel needs that are included in the budget estimate.
So it's about having input early on when the budget is still being put together.
Exactly. It gives the staff council a chance to influence how much funding and attention is given to things like training and professional development.
It's kind of like making sure employee development is baked into the financial plan from the get-go.
That's a good way to think about it. It ensures that those needs are considered when the budget is being drafted, not just as an afterthought.
The book also mentions that there are specific things that are subject to, what's the term, participation under the Federal Personnel Representation Act. Things like job advertisements, for example, under Section 75, Paragraph 3, Number 14. How does that tie into employee development?
Well, it might seem like a small detail, but the fact that job advertisements are subject to participation by the staff council highlights their broader role in personnel matters. It shows that they have a say in how the organization attracts and hires talent, which ultimately affects the pool of employees who will later need to be developed and trained.
So it's about shaping the workforce from the very beginning.
Exactly. It's about making sure that the organization is attracting the right people with the right potential for growth and development.
And the book makes a point of mentioning that the staff council has a say if the agency decides not to advertise a vacant position.
Yes, that's an important right of co-determination. If the agency chooses not to advertise an open job, the staff council can weigh in on that decision.
Why is that so important?
Well, it's about transparency and fairness. It ensures that opportunities for internal growth and promotion are considered, rather than just automatically filling positions without an open and transparent process.
So it's about making sure everyone has a fair shot at moving up within the organization.
Precisely. And it ties back to the overall theme of employee representation in personnel decisions, including those that affect career paths and development opportunities.
So for our listeners out there, I think the takeaway here is that understanding these legal frameworks is absolutely vital, especially if you're involved in employee development in any way. It's not just about doing what you think is best. It's about operating within the boundaries set by the law and respecting the rights that employees and their representatives have.
I completely agree. The employee council in the private sector and the staff council in the public sector, they both play a huge role in shaping and influencing how training and development happen within organizations. Their involvement isn't just a formality, it's a legal right. And it can significantly impact how these programs are designed and implemented.
And it's not just about planning training proactively, it's also about responding to changes in the work environment. Remember, when organizations make changes that affect job requirements, that can trigger mandatory co-determination rights for the employee council regarding training to help employees adapt.
Absolutely. It's about making sure that employees aren't left behind when their jobs change.
Ultimately, navigating these regulations successfully isn't about seeing them as obstacles, but as opportunities to create a more collaborative and, well, compliant approach to employee development. And that can benefit everyone involved.
Exactly. When everyone is on the same page and working together, it creates a much more positive and productive environment for learning and growth.
So there you have it. The legal side of employee development might not be the most glamorous topic, but it's certainly one of the most important. We've just scratched the surface here, giving you an overview of this chapter, but hopefully you now have a better understanding of the legal considerations involved.
I hope so.
And remember, folks, you can always dive deeper into the book itself to explore these topics in more detail.
Yes, the next chapter is right there waiting for you, and it's packed with even more insights into the world of personnel development.
And we'll be back to discuss it in our next deep dive. Until then, keep learning and keep growing.